I worked for a while in the hospital. How in the world did that ever happen? Well, I have a story about it. It goes like this. In the lecture room that morning, students quickly filled the seats, which were arranged like they are in a theater. We had assembled in Cudahy Hall, the venerable old science building, just off Sheridan Road, on the north side campus of Loyola University in Chicago. At last, the professor entered. This man with a bushy black beard introduced himself as Dr. Boris Firov, the head of the biology department. Before starting his lecture, aware that many of the students taking his class were aiming for medical school, he offered some advice. "You think you want to be a doctor? Go work in a hospital. See if you can tolerate the sights and smells." As one of the students, I had already taken his advice to heart. This advice, a sort of try before you buy approach, made sense to me. It was unlike other remarks I heard as a child. Like any kid, for years I had heard relatives and others pose the question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" Even then, I wondered, how could a child possibly answer that question? It struck me like the question asked by the waiter in the fancy restaurant. When you can barely decipher the menu, the waiter arrives to ask, "What do you want to eat?" How can you know what dish you might like if you've never tasted it? To know, it seemed to me, you simply have to try it. I had been accepted as a student at Loyola and began my studies declaring my major as biology, a path on which I set out using the advice of my father. When Dad looked at the results of my high school vocational testing, he observed that I showed the highest interest in language, in science, and in the social sciences. Those interests, he reasoned, came together in the practice of medicine. Why not be a doctor? In high school, the classes that most fascinated me were the science classes. I eagerly embraced his advice. As I mull over that time, I wonder how much Dad's suggestion was influenced by the stark events of his family history. His mother had been stricken with cancer, a profound event for his whole large family. Through medical intervention, she survived it. Hospital service drew in several of Dad's sisters, namely Wanda, Della, and Germaine, who subsequently studied for or became nurses. Aunt Kathy also entered nursing after she exited the convent. Interest in medicine showed up in the family history. Another haunting question lingers. Earlier, back as far as my time in grade school, a tingling numbness began in Dad's legs. I don't recall him saying much about it. It must have been Mom who let it out. It wasn't until much later that the condition bloomed into the nastier symptoms of multiple sclerosis. Did that lurking disease somehow fit into the equation? Did it have influence on me, on him? Whatever influences guided my decisions, it was the path on which I set out. The problem for me then became how to get work in a hospital. In the 1950s, suburban hospitals were few and far between. Fortunately, in Elmhurst, We had one. Founded in 1926, it was at that time the only hospital in DuPage County. But would they hire me? Well, during the summer of 1958, the summer I graduated from high school, in the maternity ward of Elmhurst Hospital, five babies mysteriously died. This unexplained calamity closed the maternity ward. It was big news. On July 1st, a banner headline on the first page of the Elmhurst Press read, "Keeping Hospital's Maternity Ward Closed Until Infection Is Located." A couple of days later, it read, "Hospital hunt could take several weeks. Medical sleuths push search for mystery ailment." Though I don't remember how it resolved, I do remember that investigators were honing in on Streptococcus as the agent. It was probably this tragic event that accounted for my summer job at Elmhurst Hospital. Because after being hired, the first task I was given was to disinfect rooms in the maternity ward. The hospital was housed in a big old red brick building of at least four stories. A newly completed addition made it a hybrid building, one that was partly old and partly new. Today's brightly decorated hospital rooms exude cheeriness, but in that old section, the paint in the halls was drab, the feeling muted. It evoked hushed tones. My grandmother, a.k.a. Grammy, was quite suspicious of hospitals, an attitude that Mom sought to explain. She said something like, "In her day, the hospital was where you went to die." What had to be disinfected was not only the floor, but the bed frames, the chairs, the cabinets, every surface of several rooms in the maternity ward. The opportunity was timely. The job, however basic and uninspiring, got me work in the hospital, and I quite helpfully sloshed surfaces with the foul-looking disinfectant. I was already fighting disease. The glue that holds this in my memory may not be the loss of human life. It may only be embarrassment. There I was, not yet out of my teen years, working in the maternity ward, the very heart of women's territory from which men were usually excluded. I don't know if the realization lit my face with a red glow, but as I walked the corridor and passed the rooms of the women's patients, I recall struggling to contain my curiosity and to keep my eyes looking straight ahead so as not to see any of the mysteries that I wasn't supposed to see. After cleansing the rooms, I was assigned to assist the nurses on a medical floor in the old section, whose facilities were more primitive than those of the newly added east wing. Rooms on the east side had private bathrooms, air conditioning, better lighting, and an intercom to the nurses' station. In that old wing of the hospital, we had none of that. Patients summoned help by pushing a button that turned on a light above the door to their room. A significant part of the job involved scampering back and forth, answering lights. This floor, to west, however, boasted young nurses and young aides. Our crew developed an esprit de corps a certain pride that on 2 West, work was tougher than it was in the rooms of the new addition. Thus began a time of education, a time of revelation. For one, it focused attention on the body, on health, on matters of life and death. It jolted me in ways that I cannot easily characterize, produced experiences that reading would never do, and I treasure them. One such eye-opening experience occurred when, for the first time, I walked into a room to find that one of my patients had died. I hastened to tell the head nurse, who after some time assigned me to take the body down to the morgue, down in the basement of the hospital. It's not as if I had never encountered dead people before. I had. Several years earlier, not long after we moved to Elmhurst, Grammy, Mom's mother, died in our new home. In comparison with that, the encounter with a dead person in the hospital felt strangely different. When Grammy received radiation treatments for cancer, the treatments exhausted her. Mom insisted on nursing her at home. To do this, Mom acquired a hospital bed and installed it in the sunroom of our house. My brother Paul rigged up a bell to ring in an upstairs bedroom. Its clanging could be heard from anywhere in the house. It allowed Grammy to summon us from wherever in the house we were. It allowed us to come and offer what comfort we could. The bell worked fine, but the help we were able to offer couldn't alter the outcome. When her time drew near, her breathing became ragged and rasping. These sounds, coming from the woman who had nurtured me, have attached to my memory as if by tattoo. They were hard to endure. The bonds of attachment to her made her death different from any other, since her loss was the loss of someone important in my life. As I reflect on it, I regard it more as a spiritual event than a bodily one. It didn't center on a dead body. In contrast, the hospital patient who had died was a patient to whom I had been assigned a day or two earlier. We never had the chance to banter. He slept much of the time. I remember him as an elderly man, but the odd thing is, I can't quite remember when he died, but I do remember the exact spot where I was standing in the hall outside his room when the head nurse asked me to get a gurney, put him on it, and to wheel him down to the morgue. In preparing for the trip to the morgue, a quirky detail pops up. It is the thing I most recall. The man must have weighed over 250 pounds, and to move him from the hospital bed onto the gurney required several of us. When that task was completed, the nurse handed me an identifying tag to attach to the body. The tag, like one you might use to identify a suitcase at the airport, attached with a few inches of string. Those few inches limited the selection of body parts to which I might attach it. I recall sheepishly returning to the nurse's station and asking, to what part of, how do I attach it? She said, figure out something. Back in the room, I squeamishly lifted one corner of the drapery with which we covered his body. Made of paper, the covering wrap felt flimsy and insufficient. His now ashen feet stuck in the air. They looked cold. My impulse was to tuck them in under a blanket. The impulse was short-circuited as it occurred to me he could no longer feel cold. It also hit me that he would no longer mind the indignity. And using my best Boy Scout square knot, I attached the tag to the big toe of his left foot and wheeled him out of the room. On my way to the morgue, my cargo and I had the freight elevator all to ourselves. Looking back at that summer, I have to say the professor's advice had been good advice. I learned so much through work at the hospital and grew up more than a little.